Good afternoon. So today, I'd like to start thinking about what we talked about last time about how device drivers work. Remember that we had part of the device driver that was called from the application as part of, for example, a read system call or needing to bring in a page, and part of the device driver which was called from the interrupt, from the trap handler. So keeping that in mind, I have a scenario here. We have two applications, A and B. A is reading from the network, so it calls read to get data from the network. It's not there yet, so it waits. Then more data than it requested comes in, and it gets the first 8K of that, and then it calls read again to get the remaining, get 4KB more. I said remaining, but obviously 8 plus 4 is not 16. And the question is, when this happens, how many mode switches do we expect? So by mode switch, kernel, user kernel mode switch, so going from user to kernel mode, and how many process context switches, switches between different processes, do we expect? So I'll give you a bit of time to think about that, and then we'll go over what I think happens, what I think reasonable answers are. And if you have questions, I'm watching the chat window. So I'll give another 30 seconds or so. So there is not much agreement here, which interesting. So let's go through sort of my reasoning for this. I think so 3 is not the answer I got, but I think what's happening is that there's an interpretation issue here. So here's a timeline I have. And I'm going to go through that. And I'm going to go through why I think happened for 3. And hopefully, it's right. 3 is not the answer I got. But it's very related to the answer I got. So, initially, A is running. And it calls read. So, this, while running A, switches to kernel mode to do the top half of the device driver, which is going to say, you know, check, okay, is there stuff in the buffer? The answer was no. So, A needs to wait. And it's going to put A to sleep. And because B has lots of computation to do, we're definitely going to run B. So that's this next thing here. We run B, and then data comes in from the network, and the OS needs to handle it. And the device controller for the network connection is going to use an interrupt to tell the OS, hey, you need to do this. And that's going to be handled immediately by the OS in kernel mode. And this is going to do the copy from the device. And also, it's going to wake up A by marking it as ready. And what happens to A depends on how the scheduler works. So one option is the scheduler could say, oh, well, A hasn't been running for a while. I really should just run it right now. Or it could just wait. We think how XP6's scheduler works. It would just wait until the next time the scheduler gets run from a timer interrupt. So it probably wouldn't happen immediately. And in this gray part, we'd end up running B, or we could run A right away. Whenever we end up running A, we're going to switch to the kernel. We're going to be in the kernel mode, and we're going to run the rest of this read system call, where read went to sleep saying there's not enough in the buffer, and we're going to run the part that copies back to A's user, then returns to A, then A runs for a bit, then there's the second read, and that just redirects right away. So we run the top half of the device driver, and this time when it checks the buffer, it says, oh, everything's fine, and it's there. So then let's count the mode switches, and this is how I did the count. So we have a switch from user to kernel mode to run the read, a switch from kernel to user mode to run B again, a switch from user to kernel mode to handle the interrupt, and assuming A runs right away, after we switch to A, we run A in kernel mode for a bit, then we switch back, that's 4, then 5 and 6 for handling the read system call. And I think what a lot of people were doing is that they were only counting switches in one direction as a mode switch, but I meant a mode switch, you know, in either direction. Maybe that could have been clearer. So this is one possibility, and this is assuming that A runs right away. If A doesn't run right away, then we're going to run B in this gray part, and that's going to be another 2 switches, giving us 8. So questions on how I got the answer for mode switches. So you're saying maybe it could be 4 switches, like maybe the interrupt comes in here, is the argument? Yes, I agree that like if we don't have to really wait for the device, yeah, maybe we could avoid this switch here. I think, you know, that's a possibility. You know, that seems unlikely if it wasn't already in the buffer. Because that just requires the device to be real fast. Okay. Other questions or comments? So the question is, does the waiting for the device need to only happen once at the beginning? Because we got 16K of data here, and we were only reading 8, that means there's 8KB right over, and this is more, so we can get the 4KB, from that 8K, 16 KB. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Comments? Okay. So then we have the second part, which is about context switches. And using my diagram, you can get two if you think A is switched to right away. So switch to B while A waits for input and switch back. You could get, if you think that the device gets the data right away without giving a B a chance to run, like we handle the interrupt right here, then you have none. Or you could get, if you think we have B running here, you could have three. So questions on the number of context switches. So that's sort of talking about this topic we talked about last time. We mentioned that there's these two parts of the device driver. So we had the part that's run from the process actually requesting the input, typically, which uses the buffer and waits for data, putting the process to sleep, and the part that runs from the interrupt handler, which fills the buffer and wakes up anyone who's waiting. We also mentioned last time how we communicate with devices with this notion that the devices expose themselves as memory, and therefore, what we're doing if we need to make a request to the device or need to fill the buffer or otherwise communicate with the device is we just do memory accesses, but they, instead of changing values in memory, they talk to the device controller, and the device controller decides what those mean. Before we talked about that, we also talked about some remaining issues with page replacement. She mentioned that in particular, when we were reading things that we would just read once, LRU often didn't do the right thing. So we had sort of two special cases to handle that. So one was acknowledging if data is only used once, we want to kind of avoid caching it, because that's not going to be useful. It's going to require us to throw away things we actually care about. And also that we wanted to deal with reading ahead, that we can predict what the programming reads next, and we should take advantage of that to sort of hide the cost of reading data. So before I move on, questions about any of these topics from last time? So, if not, I'm going to sort of expand on this sort of way we communicate with the device. So far, what we've been saying is that in this bottom half, we're doing a copy. So, this is read from the magic memory and write to buffer. And if you think about this, this seems kind of inefficient that we're doing a copy here into the kernel buffer, and then we're doing a copy into the user buffer, and that seems awfully not very efficient. And we're copying, so like we're doing like the devices has its own buffer. We're copying from that to the kernel buffer. We're copying from the kernel buffer to the user buffer. And we're going to talk about one way of mitigating this effect. And the most obvious one might be that why don't we just copy to the user buffer directly? We're not going to fix that. And we're probably not going to talk about fixing that this semester, though that's a very interesting topic that real OSs worry about, which turns out to be surprisingly tricky. We're going to talk about fixing this copy by getting some extra support from the device. And what we're going to do is called direct memory access. And this is going to be based on something very convenient about how we've set up our device controllers. Our device controllers are on the memory bus, and they're just as able to communicate with the actual memory as the processor is. They have all the same capabilities for accessing the actual memory. So what we can do is we can say, why are we bothering storing the data that we just read from the network in the device controller when we're going to want to put it in the actual memory anyways? Let's say, get rid of these buffers on the device controller, and instead of having the buffer in the device controller, let's put the buffer here, and have an address as one of the control registers. And what we'll do is the OS will allocate this buffer here, and it will tell us the physical address of the buffer, tell the device controller that. So now when the device controller reads in data, say from the network, rather than writing it to an internal buffer, it will just write it directly to memory. And hope it will write it directly to the kernel's buffer, saving that copying step, you know, which is going to be so it's less copying, and also means that the processor can be doing other stuff while this write is happening. So, you know, we're taking advantage of the fact that the device controller can do things in parallel with the processor. So this turns out to be a lot more efficient, provided that there's enough data being written to make this setup worth it. So to set this up, we had to have the OS allocate some space in memory. We had to have the OS tell the device controller about this. And we're still going to have the OS run that bottom half of the device driver. But instead of copying from the buffer, copying from the device buffer to the kernel buffer, it's going to figure out, okay, how much stuff is in the kernel buffer? Who do I have to wake up? We have to do the rest of the bookkeeping still. We don't get rid of that step, but we eliminate this potentially expensive copy. And after this happens, so the S in that bottom half or in the top half can read directly from the memory location it specified earlier. And you could imagine that in a more sophisticated version of this, we could maybe choose the location that the program has to read. And this seems like it should be straightforward, but it turns out to be really difficult in practice. So typically, the OS will just choose its kernel buffer location. But the ideal would be that we could make this happen and have no copying whatsoever. The data comes on the network, goes directly where you're reading it. But typically, that sort of thing is hard. So questions on our direct memory access idea. Okay, so this is commonly used for disk and network I/O. For disk I/O, you know, tell disk the page cache address. Like, we have a way of, like, avoiding copies and so on. And for network I/O, probably there's still a kernel buffer. So there's a question, how do we avoid message collisions? So the bus is a lot more intelligent, intelligent might be the wrong word. It has a lot more functionality in the hardware than I've kind of led on. So there is some hardware that makes up this bus that has some scheme for deciding who gets to send when. Okay. That's about, yeah, how do we avoid collisions? Yeah, so the bus has to have some functionality to make that possible. So this is a lot faster for disk network I/O where we have a lot of data because the processor doesn't run the loop and we can give a very large buffer space. And if we're really lucky, you know, we can put it directly where we want. And I've alluded that this often doesn't actually happen. And I'll talk briefly about what's hard about that. We're not going to talk about how we fix it. You know. So, you know, we could put it in the device driver's buffer. That's the straightforward thing. And we might want to put it where the application wants it. But the reason it's hard to do is that the devices often have restrictions, like they might expect contiguous physical addresses. So if we have the program's memory is not contiguous physically because the page table entries don't go to the consecutive pages, that might be a problem. They might require things to be page aligned and the call to read might not be that way. They might not have it in the same format, so the device driver might be translating. So for example, the keyboard in XV6 doesn't actually give ASCII characters. And we also need to deal with what if there's too much data and so on. So there's all these sort of considerations. So usually it's the device driver's buffer. Probably the big exception is we can probably arrange to read directly into the page cache for disk I/O. So that's where I'm going to finish up about devices. So we have this big idea that the device controllers were connected to the via the memory bus. So they looked like magic memory to the OS. We had the two parts of our device drivers. You know, we had one part which sort of queued the request that was run from the application, the other part which handled from an interrupt, either copying the data and waking things up, or learning that the device copied the data itself, and dealing with, here's some new data, what do I do with it? So any questions about anything with devices before we go to our next topic about file systems? So we're going to start by talking about the FAT file system, and there's two reasons for this. So one is we have an assignment about it, and the second is it's probably the simplest file system that's actually widely used. Well, it's really a family of file systems. We're going to talk about it as if it's monolithic, but there's really a couple variants, but they're all widely used, and we're going to, you know, talk about how it works in a lot of detail. And then we're going to look at a more traditional Unix file system and talk about how those work. So the FAT file system is named for an important data structure called the file allocation table. So it's named after that. So this is the most important thing in the FAT file system. And we're going to get to that later. But first, talk about file systems. So file systems mean we have a hard drive and somehow we store files on the hard drive, even though the hard drive doesn't natively have any actual files. So one question might be, like, what does the disk look like to the OS? And our model of the disk for FAT is we're going to divide it up into what we'll call clusters. And we'll just say that the disk is an array of these clusters. And each of these clusters has some size between say, half a kilobyte in 4K. It could be bigger, it could be smaller. And these clusters are going to be composed of sectors. And this is what the hardware is going to expose to us. So this is the hardware unit. And sectors are going to, historically, were half a kilobyte. This is just a choice that hard drive manufacturers made. Now, they're sometimes a bit bigger because people have learned maybe half a kilobyte is a little small. And when you're talking to the hardware, a sector is the minimum unit you can read or write, as it turns out. So when you're talking to the hardware, our model for now is going to be that you tell it, this sector, write this data, or this sector, read it. And that's what you do. You can't actually do smaller units. So if you want to only read a portion of this sector here, then what you have to do is read the whole thing and extract the portion you care about. If you want to only write a portion of the sector, you have to read the whole sector, modify the part you care about, write the whole thing back. And that defines these bigger units they call clusters, or potentially bigger. And the reason for that is that they might want to do things in larger units to limit bookkeeping, and because it, as it turns out, it's more efficient, and they don't want to be tied to the decision the hardware made. So they have a separate decision for the units they work in, called, they call clusters, and often they'll choose to say, have a, you know, a cluster be composed of several sectors together, you know, a whole number of sectors to keep things simple, but several sectors together so they don't have to be tied to whatever decision the hardware made. So questions about sectors and clusters? So clusters are the unit that FAT's going to divide the disk into, and we talked about storing files, and so our first thing we're going to sort of talk about is, well, a file has a bunch of data. Where do we store that data? What we're going to do in the FAT file system is we're going to choose a list of clusters and store the file's data there. And you might observe that, well, the file's data probably is not a whole multiple of the cluster size. And we're not going to fix that. We're just going to say, okay, in that case, we're not using all that space, but we're still going to assign it all to the file. So like we might have here a file example.txt that we store in 1, 2, 3, 4 clusters. And if example.txt is, you know, only needs 3.5, well, the last cluster is only going to be half used, but we're still going to assign the whole thing to the file. And this means that when we read a file or want to modify a file in place, we're going to need to find this list of clusters. So this gets us to sort of our next question, which is, if I know, you know, I want to read a file, how do I get this list of clusters? Like, we're not going to have a picture. We need to have something we can read that tells us where these clusters are. And in fact, the file allocation table is going to tell us what this list of clusters is in a particular way. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to store a linked list. But we're not going to store it, you know, with memory addresses because the disk isn't memory. We're going to like store it with disk addresses, which are going to be cluster numbers. So the file allocation table is going to be this big array where for every cluster, we have a pointer, which the pointer is just another cluster number that tells us the next cluster after that. So this is just an array of next pointers for our linked list of clusters. So this means when we want to read a file, we look up this array, and which is going to be in a well-known location on the disk. We read it in the part we care about, and figure out from that what the next cluster number is once we know the first one. We'll get to the question later, the obvious question of how do we know what the first cluster number is? Well, let's assume we're told. We're told, that, for example, that example.txt starts on, let's say, cluster 10. So in that case, we're going to get our array, we're going to read the relevant part of it, and we're going to look up the entries here. So there's a file here starting at cluster 10, and after cluster 10, the next part of its data is in cluster 14, then 15, then 13, and we need to have some sort of thing that represents null. I'm going to use -1 in my examples. It may be different in real fact. In the real system, you'll need to read the things we link to in the assignment when you're doing the assignment for this, but I'll just use -1 to keep things simple. This is sort of our equivalent of null. And so once we get this, we know, okay, this is where the data is, and we can ask the disk, hey, here's the clusters I want. We can translate those to sector numbers the disk understands and say, read all of this, organize it in the right order, and give it to the application that's asking to read this file. So questions about this idea of a linked list of cluster numbers? Okay, so I've told you about this array with our next pointer. So question would be, where is that stored? We're just going to choose a location on the disk, generally near the beginning of the disk, and just assign it to this array. So here's my file allocation table, a subset, and we decided that this is going to be stored in clusters 2 through 4. And to find each file, you know, this represents a linked list. So for example, here at index 7, I have a pointer to 8. And a pointer to 9, and then an end mark. So there's a file that starts, that if it starts at index blocks in the cluster 7, has 3 blocks of data that happen to be all be next to each other on the disk. We have another file, the one we just talked about, which if it starts at cluster 10, has 4 blocks of data, cluster 10, then 14, then 15, then 13. Don't have to be in order. So if we read this file, we're going to have to handle putting them in the correct order. And we have plenty more files, so more pointers. And you notice that files don't need to be even remotely contiguous. Like there's some file that has data at cluster 12, where the next cluster of data is at cluster 54. And that's perfectly allowed. So now we know, okay, the fat entry is going to be at some location. So our process for reading a file is we get its start location. We'll talk about how we do that in a bit. We read the first cluster. Then we check the fat to figure out, is there a next cluster? We read the next cluster and so on until we get an end marker. So this gets us the data for the file. We're missing two things, how we get the start location, and also we're missing, you know, what about, you know, what if last cluster is not all used? Like, we don't yet have a way of not returning junk after the end of the file. And we'll fix both of these problems by telling you how we're going to deal with directories. This is our scheme for files. So another question is, if the fat table takes up more than one cluster, how do you know where it ends? We'll talk about that later too. And it's going to be the same sort of way we know where it starts. And there's something missing we need to figure that out. As indeed, like, its size varies depending on how big our hard drive is. So let's start with our start locations. And this is going to have to be with a directory. And we don't want to say, hey, I want to read file at cluster 10. That's not usable. We want file names. And we're going to put file names in directories. And the way FAT treats directories is directories are files. Like, they store data, but the data, rather than being like data that you'd like open up in a text editor or something like that, is a list of information about other files. So a list of its name, its starting location, and also some other information about the files. So the directory is going to be stored the same way as files. It's going to be a list of clusters, but rather than those clusters containing, you know, things the user tried to store there, they contain information about other files. So let's say here we have a directory, and our directory is stored in two clusters, let's say. So that means that there's FAT entries. The FAT entry for 9 gives number 13. The FAT entry for 13 gives the end mark. And in these clusters, the data says, hey, there's a file index.html. It starts at cluster 10. And also, it's this long. Why do we say how long it is? Because this tells us, is the last cluster, how much of the last cluster is used? This is how we find that out. You know, file assignments.html starts at 17, and we have this whole list of information. You know, and notably, we have the starting cluster number, and we have the size, so we can figure out, once we know that size, that, oh, this last cluster of index.html has some unused bytes, so I don't need to give those to the application. So, and note that we can have directory entries also for other directories, and as we'll find out later, we can have unused entries. So we can have holes, and this makes it more convenient to like delete a file. So questions about this idea of directory entries? So I've told you sort of like what directory entries contain, but they're actually in a bit of a different format. So I'm going to show you a dump of the bytes in an example directory entry in FAT as a sequence of bytes where it's an ASCII character. I've put just quote R here for the ASCII character capital R. And you might say that there's a lot wrong with this format, and there is, but this is what was chosen way back in the days when DOS was important, so there are some bad choices here. And this is the entry for a file called readme.txt that's 342 bytes and starts at cluster number 104F4 in hexadecimal. The question about my last example was I assuming the clusters were 4K? Yes, in this example, the clusters were 4K. We'll talk later about how they can be variable size and how that works. So going to my directory entry example, so what they've chosen to do here is that we have the file name, we have some attributes, and other things. We'll go through some pieces of this. So we have the cluster number. For historical reasons, it's split into two pieces. There's the high bits and the low bits, and they're stored separately. The reason it's in two pieces is that it used to be the case that cluster numbers were 16 bits, and then they realized that people like hard drives that aren't, you know, several gigabytes, and that didn't work out anymore. So they added 16 more bits and a place they could find space for. So the cluster number split into these two pieces, and it's stored in little endian, which is why it's one, you know, this is starts with a one here in the high bits, because there's a one in the, you know, bit 16 if we start numbering at zero. Okay, so that's our cluster number. We have our file name, and this is stored with an 8-character file name and a 3-character extension. You might say that that's not really very useful. This is what DOS decided to do, and this is the base format that's done. So FAT does support longer file names, and this is encoded in a rather complicated way that we are not having you do in the assignment because it's not actually especially interesting from a file system design point of view. You know, if they were, you know, actually designing this from scratch, they just make this field bigger. Or something like that. But they just, you know, were stuck when doing eight character file names plus 3-character extensions. So that's what they're doing. And we're not going to worry about how those longer file names are encoded. But there's a way where they just use more directory entries to do it. Okay, so that's what was used to be all that supported. We have this attributes field, and this is a number where each bit like indicates extra information. So is it a subdirectory or a normal file? Is it read-only? And so on. This is also used to handle those longer file names. This marks this is part of a longer file name. So there's another sort of metadata thing with these directory entries, which is that sometimes the directory entries are used for things that aren't files. And there's two types of special things. So one is there's a directory entry that indicates there are no more directory entries here. And they put a null character in the first byte of the directory entry for that. Another is a hole. So when you delete a file, if you think we have this list of files in the directory, it would be really annoying to have to rewrite the whole directory to get rid of a file that's near the beginning of that list. So to allow the OS not to do that, they have a way of representing an unused directory entry in the middle of directory entries. And they do that by using the value hex E5 as the first byte of the file name, which they have chosen to not allow as the first byte of a real file name. So we know that that's not valid. Okay. So there's some other fields here. I'll just talk briefly. There's a creation date and time, a last access date, a last write time, and these are encoded in some horrible way that's probably a bad decision. And we're not going to go into detail about that. You can look it up if you want to. So questions about our directory entry. Okay, so that's our directory entry. So I've shown you what that looks like sort of pictorially, and you're going to have to write code that deals with directory entries. And I'm going to strongly suggest that you use a very common trick in real OSs, which is to figure out how to declare in C or whatever language you're writing your OS in, a structure with the same representation in memory. And so our idea is that this is going to we're going to carefully write this struct definition, which I've done here, so it looks exactly like this in memory. And then we can just copy from disk into memory in one of these structs and access the fields like a normal struct, rather than needing to go to this diagram and say, where are the attributes that 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So byte 11, so I don't need to do that. Rather than asking for byte 11, I just say dot dir adder once I've copied into the struct. And this is almost always how real file system code in OSs is written, is that they lay out this struct in whatever language they're using, so they don't need to like count bytes like that. They just use the name to access the fields. So to make this work in C, we need to use a compiler extension. And the big one here is this attribute pact. This is how we tell GCC or Clang, hey, I want this laid out exactly as I've written it. Please don't add any extra empty space, known as padding. The compiler normally would, because the compiler usually thinks, okay, you don't want these fields of the struct to, for example, have an integer that crosses a page boundary, because that's going to actually be much slower to access. So usually they'll add padding to make it so that will never happen. This says, don't do that. I know it's going to be slower, but it's going to help me a lot because this is going to match the layout I expect. And the other thing I've done here is I have type defs for an integer that's exactly 8 bytes, exactly 16 bits, and exactly 32 bits. So I can just copy directly, and I don't need to worry about how big is an int on my system because I'm using this type def. The other thing we might need to worry about is endianness. It happens that fat chooses to store everything in little endian, and we're just going to assume our system is little endian for the assignment. If that wasn't the case, we'd have to like do some sort of wrapping where we always can do swapping of bytes when we access these fields. So I have carefully laid out the struct. One thing you might wonder is, why did you choose all these horrible names? These are variable names you should never use. Why would you abbreviate first FST? Why wouldn't you write out cluster? We aren't like starved for characters. I chose these names to match Microsoft's documentation. That's why. Because I think that's probably more valuable than having a, nicer naming convention. So that's sort of how we're going to access these in C. So if you want to use this with a directory, we read from the disk into the structs, and then we're set. And reading from the disk, and just cast it to this struct, and we're, that's all we need to do to access the directory entries. Now, I've only talked about sort of accessing a file in one directory. In a real OS, we're going to get some path like this. We're say foo, directory foo, contains bar, contains baz, contains file.txt. So to read this file from the disk, we first need to find foo in what we call the root directory. Then we read foo's directory's entries to find bar. Then we read bar's directory entries to find baz. Then we read baz's directory's entries to find file.txt. And that's going to be our process. So you see there's a whole bunch of steps to resolve this path. And this seems like it's probably a little expensive. The reason why you don't notice this in practice, one of the reasons why, is because we have things like the page cache. So we typically aren't actually reading every time you access file.txt. Every time you open it, we're reading it from the cache, these directory entries. Okay. So there's something missing here, though, which is I need to get to the root directory. So how do I do that? So we're going to talk about that next, but before I move on, like this process clear, how we're going to access file.txt, given this path that, like, for example, might be passed to open. Okay. So this gets the question of where is our root directory? And this time I'm also going to answer some of our prior questions about how do I know how big the fat is? And how do I know like cluster sizes and things like that? And the answer is that we're going to have to store this information somewhere. All this information about the file system, like where's the root directory, where's the fat, how big is the fat, all that stuff. And we're going to store it in what we'll call a header. And the fat header is stored just at the near the beginning of the disk at a fixed location. So no matter what disk we get, no matter what settings it has for where the FAT is, where the root directory is, we don't need to know that in order to start using the disk. Instead, we just read this header and get all that information. And this header includes information like how big are clusters. So the cluster size could vary, but when we set up the disk, we'll choose a number, a size for clusters, and when we use a disk that's already set up, we'll read that number, and therefore we'll use the correct size, whether it's 4K, 2K, or whatever. There's also a number that Microsoft calls reserve sectors, and this tells us where the FAT is. So the idea is that we have space before the FAT that's called reserve sectors, and the FAT is immediately after that. And this is in sectors, not clusters, which is why I have 5 here, which is a little more than a cluster. And then we have a field telling us how big the FAT is. So that's the FAT size in sectors. And that's how we know where it ends. And another field we're going to have is where the root directory is, the cluster of the root directory. This is the first cluster. And because directories have a special directory entry indicating end of directory, we don't have to worry about what if the last cluster of the root directory isn't all used. We can get, the second cluster of the root directory if there is one from the FAT. And once we get to the last cluster where the FAT tells us there's no more, we're going to have a directory entry saying, hey, you're done reading that cluster, even though the last part isn't used. Now, there's something else in here that is a little weird, which is this number of FATs. You might say, wait, you talked about the file allocation table having data for each cluster. Why do we need more? Well, we don't need more. So we're going to have typically a second FAT that's a backup. And the reason for this is that it would be really disappointing if this part of the disk fails and suddenly we can't access any of our files. So to mitigate that, FAT has chosen to have a second copy of the FAT afterwards. So if that happens, hopefully we can still get read our files. So questions about our file system header. So why does FAT ever fail? So FAT is not what's failing, it's the hard drive that's failing. So for example, as we'll probably talk about either later today or next time, hard drives have a pretty high failure rate. Like if they're highly used, like something between like 1% and 8% per year. For some types of failures, and especially more historically, it was worse. So parts of the hard drive could become inaccessible due to how the hardware works. So question is, if the hard drive fails, couldn't the backup FAT be accessed? So there are different types of hard drive failures. And for hard drives, a common type of failure will result in part of the hard drive becoming inaccessible. So the backup FAT is mitigating it against that. And I would say, unlike solid state disks, it's much more common for hard drives to fail in a way where only part of the hard drive is inaccessible. The question is the FAT always contiguous? Does it need to be expanded? Because the FAT has one entry for each cluster, and we know how big the hard drive is when we start, typically, generally it's going to be fixed when we set up the disk. If you wanted to move your file system from a smaller disk to a bigger disk, this is something you could do, but you'd have to deal with what about the files that are stored here. And there are actually programs which will resize the FAT and do that, but they're going to do that by moving these files out of the way first. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's our file system header. And like with our directory entries, we can represent that as a struct in C, so we can just copy it from the disk into memory, cast it as the struct, and access the fields. And we have the fields I showed you earlier, like the bytes per sector, sectors per cluster, the reserved sector count, so the space before the file allocation table, number of FATs, and similar. And I'm going through this quickly because we point you to the official Microsoft documentation on what all these fields mean, which is better than my lecture slides. Okay. So I've talked all about everything we need now to read a file given a file name. And we're missing, what about, say, creating a file? So one part is kind of clear. We can add a directory entry. And often there's going to be extra space in the directories cluster. So that's pretty easy. But then we have to put the file's data somewhere. We have to choose where to put it. And we haven't gotten to the question of, like, how do we figure out where we can put a file? And after we've chosen that, we're going to update the FAT to set up those links. So I think our first step is straightforward, assuming the directory has extra space at the end. And our last step is straightforward, assuming we've actually chosen the clusters. But how do we choose the clusters? And in the FAT, our answer is going to be that we're going to use our file allocation table to tell us where we can store the file. So what we're going to do is we're going to store a special value. I've chosen to use 0 to represent free clusters, so clusters which currently do not have data in them that we care about. And I wanted to allocate a file. I just scan through the file allocation table, and however I want, we'll talk over the next several lectures about maybe considerations we might have, but it's correct however I want. I just choose some of these. So if I have 3 cluster file to store, choose 3 of these, fill them in to link them up. So I linked up 21 to 22, 22 to 24. I skipped over a cluster that was used by another file. And there I've set it up. So now I have my file, my space for my new file set up. So that's choosing the clusters. And we've chosen the clusters. We know our starting cluster is 21. So we're going to add it to the directory. And the easy case is there's an unused entry in the directory because the directory had a whole cluster and didn't use all of it. So we just add to it and write our information about the file there. Now, it might be the case that we're not out of space in this directory, that there wasn't any unused entries. In that case, we can add a cluster to the directory. And how do we do that? We choose a free cluster by looking in the FAT, then we, set up that cluster to contain all unused entries and write the first one as not an unused entry. So questions about this whole process of choosing places to put a file and adding to the directory to make it, adding to the directory, either replacing an unused entry or adding a whole new cluster if we don't have any unused entries and we still need to add to the directory. Okay, so since we know about that, so our question is where is the location of the directory entry second cluster stored? So like with the file allocation table with update we did for the file, we're going to have to update in this case. This is going to be represented FAT entry for cluster 8 contains 5. That's how that's going to be represented. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, that in mind, here's question. So I have the file abc.txt, and okay, I'll answer that question. I'll preview this and then answer that question. So I have a file abc.txt. I'm asking you to think about which things on the disk are modified when we're creating c.txt, assuming the directories already exist. And I'm going to also go to these next questions here of if we're truncating it, so c.txt has data, we're making it empty, or moving it from directory B into its parent directory A. And I'll start the quiz question and answer your question while we're doing that. So the question is, how does the file system decide which free cluster to use? There's a bunch of ways it could do that. Simplest thing is you could choose the first one. As for the better choice, that's going to be based on how we think disk works. So we're going to talk about when disks are faster, and the basic intuition is going to be that we're going to want to try to choose a bunch of clusters that are near each other for the file, or near other things we'll access at the same time. And other question is, what's the benefit of many ending entries pointing to negative one? So negative one isn't what they're pointing to. It's just a sentinel value, like a null at the end of a linked list. And it turns out not to actually be negative one in practice. There's multiple possible sentinel values, but basically it's just a special value that's not a real cluster number to say this doesn't go anywhere. Does that answer both of your questions? Okay. So I'll give people another 30 seconds or so for this first question. So, I'll finish up here. Okay, so let's share. Okay, so we have consensus that we need to modify the fat entries for c.txt. So this is for one, this is mark not free. So even if it's only one cluster, we need to set a fat entry to say, this is no longer a free cluster. And if it's more than one cluster, we need to, and maybe link up clusters. If it's more than one cluster, we'll need to set up the linking. And the data clusters to store the data, store the contents. So maybe you say, assuming there is contents, and assuming we're creating it with contents, which maybe wasn't clear. Empty. So if it's non-empty, then we do that. If it's not non-empty, then we might not need to. Now we need to store when we choose where to put c.txt, we need to store that information here. So store new directory entry. So we definitely need to modify the data cluster for B. And it could be the case that we need to allocate a new data cluster to fit that directory entry. So this is maybe if we need more space for the directory entry. Okay. Now I don't believe we actually need to modify anything about A to make this work. Ignoring modification timestamps, because there's an argument maybe we need to modify the modification timestamp for B and A. But ignoring that, we shouldn't actually need to modify A, I believe. So questions about this. What does it say next to data clusters for C? Store the contents. Other questions? Okay, so let's try the second question here. So here I'm saying we want to truncate the file. So c.txt has some data and we want to make it be a 0-byte file. So, no one's responded yet. Is there interesting? There's a poll. I don't see it. Interesting. Thank you, Zoom. How about now? Okay. There we go. So I'll probably give people another 30 seconds. Okay, looks like, well, we have consensus on pretty good consensus on the most on part of it, which is tricky. Okay, so this is a prop question where we get into some issues of the may being important. So I think for this, I'm going to write my answers in blue for two. No need to clear, because there are no pointers to these, no pointers to clusters. So I don't think we actually would want to actually change the data clusters for c.txt, because what we're going to do instead is we're just going to say these aren't in use anymore, and if they are used again, they'll be overwritten. So there's actually no reason to clear the data clusters for c.txt. What we're going to do instead is we're going to mark the file as mark clusters unused. So we're going to mark its clusters as unused, and that's how we're going to deal with the data in them. So nothing is going to use the data anymore because they're listed as free, and we're going to edit the directory entry, edit size in the directory entry to indicate, no, really, don't use the files data. So the question is, when would you clear the data cluster? So the only time you really need to do that, so I could imagine clearing it if you think it's important that if you truncate a file that its data is not recoverable, but in general, you'd only clear it if you have some other reason to use those clusters. For example, you're writing a new file. Does that answer your question? Okay. And note that the important thing is we need to edit B because B has the directory entry, and that says how big the file is, and we want to change the length of the file. Question is, doesn't the directory entry need to point to a cluster? I'm not actually sure, but regardless of whether it does, we still need to edit the size in the directory entry. So the question is, I think the answer is C and E, yes. So C, E, and for the first one, I believe it was B, C, E, F. Question, wouldn't we have to indicate the clusters are zero for overwritable? That is not a change to the clusters themselves, but to the fat entry for the clusters for C. So you're right, we have to indicate they're overwritable, but we do that by changing the fat entry, not by actually editing anything in the cluster itself. Got other questions? Okay. I'm going to skip the last example here for time. And so we talked about part of deleting files, and the rest of deleting a file, which we didn't talk about, is you just overwrite the directory entry with an unused one. Okay. And and do I do my next exercise? I guess I do. Okay. So you won't get to hard drives today, but that's fine. So here's, we'll do the first exercise here. And I'm asking, I have a directory of 230 kilobyte files in this fat file system. How much space does it take up? And, I guess I'm asking both questions, but I only really care about, I will only go over the first one for time reasons. And I'll cut people off in 30 seconds so I have enough time to go over the first one. Okay, so I'll end it here. We'll go over, I'll go over logic here. So I don't think people are missing some clusters. So the obvious thing is this data. So this is, so how do we store this? So each file is 15 clusters and happens to fit exactly times 200 files. So that's 3,000 clusters for the file data itself. But we also need to store the directory entries. And we have 32 bytes times 200 bytes of 200 of directory entries. And this turns out to be, so we have, let me make sure I use my calculator to not mess this up. So this is 6,400 bytes, which is going to, which is not a whole number of clusters. So that's, that takes up, which is 3.125 clusters. And we have to round up because we're not going to use all of the last cluster. So the number I got was 3,004. Clusters. So for the number of clusters. Any questions on that? Okay, so that's where I'll leave off for today. I would note that this lecture should give you enough to start the fat read assignment, which is part of the purpose and part of why we're doing things in a kind of odd order. So next time we'll talk about how hard drives work, even though, you know, it might have seemed to make sense to do that after, so before talking about file systems, but we're going to do it earlier, so we did the file system earlier so you can start that assignment as soon as possible. Okay. Any last questions before I finish up? Okay, I don't see any.